The Murder Shelf Book Club contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Listener discretion is advised.
Homes are where people live to feel safe. He continued that Brady climbed into Smith's home through the window. Minutes later, after hearing three gunshots, Keifer crawled through the same window. The defense argued that the three shots should have warned her not to enter the home. They believed Keifer thought the shots came from Brady, which was why she went looking for him. If the two teens wouldn't have committed a felony burglary, then they would still be alive today. Defense attorney Stephen Meshbesher from Murder on Elm Street by Jeremy L. Lubertz. Well, welcome to the Murder Shelf Book Club podcast. I am your host, Jill. This is episode 86, Lesser of Two Evils, part 3 of Murder on Elm Street by Jeremy L. Lubertz. In 7 weeks, I'm going to be on Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2024 in Nashville, May 31st to June 2nd. I am looking forward to hearing what you have to say, Murder Boogies. So swing by and say hi. And remember, you can save 10% on your CrimeCon badge using my code. All one word, lowercase letters, MurderShelf. I am looking to set up some kind of meetup for us, so stay tuned as the schedule comes out. So, brief recap. In episode 85, The Motherlode, Byron Smith has been charged with 2 counts of second-degree homicide. Morrison County Sheriff's Office had uncovered an audio recording of Byron Smith where prior to the break-in, he appears to be rehearsing conversation with his brother and the police as if he's anticipating some dire action. And then we hear the murder of teenage burglars Nicholas Brady and Haley Keifer, moaning, cries, as Byron coldly dispatched the duo into death. At his bail hearing, the judge had reduced Byron's bail to $500,000 from $1 million, and his family was able to bail him out, which is very concerning to lead investigator Jeremy Lubertz and his wife Chrissy and family. The autopsy reports on Brady and Keifer were done by Dr. Kelly Mills and was sent over to the sheriff's office. Nick had 3 gunshot wounds, 3 exit wounds, which all did serious damage. There were no drugs or alcohol found in his system. Haley Keifer had 6 gunshot wounds, 1 entering her left eye as she laid injured. She had no alcohol in her system, but tested positive for THC, also known as the active ingredient in marijuana, and dextromethorphan, which is found in cough syrup and is occasionally abused by teenagers. She would have been quite high when she was killed, and I wonder how much of her thinking was compromised as well. This, coupled with the audio recording, Jeremy had no doubt that Byron Smith had 0 intention of catching burglars. He was intending to murder them, extracting revenge. Question was, would a jury agree? Nick and Haley are not innocent parties here. They were committing a felony crime, entering Byron's home to rob him. And Byron has certainly been victimized. However, Jeremy believes their actions were the lesser of two evils. A man of faith, Jeremy believes that Satan is the father of lies and evil, who has done fairly well for himself in this case. He tempted and manipulated Nick and Haley's lust and greed for material possessions, and fueled Byron's fear and rage. Quote, "After all of the terrible acts I've encountered in my 17 years as a deputy, I've come to believe that there is an evil, dark force at work in this world, and I pray often that things will get better." End quote. As do I, Jeremy. As do I. Across the town of Little Falls, the conversation, often heated, was Byron Smith. In the grocery stores, Walmart, auto shop, church, school, work, on television. And this wasn't limited to just town or even Minnesota. This was a national debate with emotions running high. Jeremy's dad noticed how divided the community was because he was often asked about the case at his shop. Out on bail, Byron Smith was lodging with neighbors John and Kathleen Lang. This arrangement would last for 16 months. John Lang would tell CBS News, quote, "I'll never forget one day we were walking back down the road, down his road, and we were carrying a bunch of stuff to my place. And he just fell down on the road and started crying. And I said, 'Byron, what's the matter?' And he looked back at his house and just started crying. He said, 'I can't even live in my own house anymore. I can't even live at my own house anymore.'" End quote. Jeremy's great uncle was friends with Lang and many of Byron's supporters, who were 100% on his side. If you break into someone's house and rob them, well, you accept the consequences, period. Jeremy's wife, Chrissy, also noted the same divisions among her coworkers. The news media was working overtime in getting the opinions of residents and stirring the pot. Few to none actually understood what the evidence was, which did not stop people from being very angry with Jeremy and, by extension, Chrissy. It was very hard to keep his mouth shut, but he was determined to live up to this test of his oath of office. It is a very heavy burden that law enforcement bears, and he and his twin brother and fellow deputy, Jamie Luberts, felt it heavily. Called in to meet with County Attorney Brian Middendorf, Jeremy learned that the Minnesota Attorney General's office had refused to take over the prosecution of Smith. Brian suspected it was just too political for them to get involved, which is cowardly as hell, by the way. Just follow the law. Brian was now asking other county attorneys to assist. Eventually, Washington County's Peter Orput would agree to take the case. An excellent attorney, he had a ton of experience in prosecuting homicide cases. Months later, Jeremy heard that Peter Orput was outside waiting for him at the sheriff's department. A tall, skinny, buck-toothed, middle-aged man greeted Jeremy, who wrote, quote, "My first impression was that he looked like someone from the Revenge of the Nerds movie," end quote. They shared a cigarette, engaged in some friendly banter, and shared professional experience, coming to realize that they would work really well together. Fast forward a year, the grand jury was about to convene. In Minnesota, grand juries have between 16 and 32 jurors. If a charged offense can result in life in prison, the grand jury must convene. Now keep in mind, grand juries only hear from the prosecution and determine if there's a likelihood that a crime was committed, with a minimum of 12 jurors needing to agree. And then an indictment is issued. Witnesses can be subpoenaed and are sworn in. I served on grand jury back in New Jersey, which was 18 weeks, and it was an absolutely amazing experience that I really value. I learned so much about law, procedure, and I met the most amazing people, so I highly recommend it if you are fortunate enough to be called. A lot of people try to get out of it. I recommend it. Now, Jeremy had testified in many felony cases during his career, but never in a grand jury for such a high-profile case. After carefully studying his notes, case documents, Jeremy felt ready to testify accurately and factually, and April 23, 2013 came with Pete Orput putting him on the stand. With butterflies dancing in his stomach, 23 sets of eyes locked on him. Sworn in, Orput and his assistant, Brent Wartner, got down to the events of November 23, 2012, when he was called to Smith's residence. Jeremy succinctly articulated what he observed, glancing to see a fully engaged jury earnestly listening. He described the interviews he'd had with Byron Smith, and then played the audio recording for the jurors with transcripts provided as well. 90 minutes later, they moved on to aerial photographs, explaining where Nick Brady and Byron Smith's vehicles were positioned. Nick's a block down from Byron's home, and Byron's pickup a quarter or 0.4 miles away. Once the prosecutors were done, the grand jurors had the opportunity to ask questions. One asked for clarity about the reading chair in the basement that was oddly positioned. Another asked if the environment in the basement was conducive for reading. Was it well lit? And Jeremy said he did not believe it was well lit nor a good place to read because the light bulbs had been removed. I believe Smith was busy watching his security monitors to see if his burglars were lulled into his trap. I don't believe he was reading, not without lights working. Another juror asked, quote, "At any time when you spoke with him, did he indicate any names other than what we believe were his neighbors' names or reference to his neighbors?" Answer, "From what I recall, he referred to the female many times, and each time he talked about her to me, he basically meant Ashley Williams, who was his neighbor right next door." Question, "Did he give you any indication that he realized that this was not Ashley Williams lying on the floor?" Answer, "No," end quote. It's a rather astute question, I think. Smith actually thought it was Ashley he had shot and killed, not Haley. Another that I thought was very insightful. A juror asked if moving the pickup truck was a setup, and Jeremy told them that yes, he believed it was. Wrapping up, Jeremy left the courtroom and the BCA agents entered to testify. And on April 24, 2013, the Morrison County Grand Jury handed down a sealed indictment for two counts of premeditated murder in the first. If found guilty, Smith would get life in prison without parole. With the indictments now premeditated murder, Prosecutor Orput requested the bail be increased to $2 million. Judge Anderson denied the request, keeping bail at $50,000. Byron Smith would remain free until the criminal trial verdict was rendered. That is just unbelievable to me. I just don't understand it. I understand he's innocent until proven guilty, but this was really calculated behavior with an abundance of evidence proving it. So I think that was the wrong call, and I will make sure I ask Jeremy about you, Judge Anderson. Time went by as trial prep went forward. Chrissy was increasingly anxious, noticing strange cars driving past the house, staring as they did so. Jamie and Jeremy both noticed Bill Anderson and John Lang specifically. On Facebook, Jeremy received stranger friend requests constantly from all over the country, so he dropped all social media. He suspected that he and Jamie were being targeted by friends of the defense. After work one night, Jeremy noticed a car parked in an alley next to his neighbor's, with a guy in the car holding binoculars to his eyes. Closing the shades, Jeremy called dispatch and reported suspicious activity. A little false squad car arrived, having a little chat with the driver, who then drove away. The officer told Jeremy he was a private investigator. Sharing this with Jamie, he had also noticed that car too, and it seemed that the defense was trying to catch the Luberts misbehaving so they could use it against them at trial. Well, if this is your defense's strategy and what your defense is resting on, it's not going well for Byron. And all this achieved was in making the Luberts' lives miserable. And speaking to their character, neither Jeremy nor Jamie extracted revenge by retaliating. Jeremy believes in this part of the Lord's Prayer, quote, "As we forgive those who trespass against us," end quote. He would readily forgive, but not forget. All right, so this was a new term to me. Under Minnesota law, an omnibus hearing has to be held in felony and gross misdemeanor cases if a defendant pleads not guilty. So I wasn't sure exactly what an omnibus hearing is. And having a few questions, I contacted the Prosecutor's Podcast with Brett and Alice, which is one of my favorites. And they very kindly responded and explained that it's basically a preliminary hearing with a fancy name and a few more boops and whistles. So thank you very much for Brett and Alice. I could have spent a lot of time trying to dig that one out. Jeremy writes, if either side demands a hearing, an omnibus occurs, hearing all motions related to probable cause, evidentiary issues, discovery, admissibility of other bad acts and crimes, admissibility of relationship evidence, prior sexual conduct, constitutional issues, procedural issues, aggregate sentence, and anything else that's fair game. All related evidence is presented to the court. All witnesses are sequestered or excluded from the courtroom and can be cross-examined, and this is open to the public. I am not getting into all the legalese here, and to your absolute benefit, Jeremy's book reads like a legal primer on how to understand how this system works. It's really incredible. Peter Orput told Jeremy to expect questions about the search warrants and statements. The defense's goal was to get them thrown out. So, on August 30th, Jeremy returned to the court to testify again, this time answering the ton of questions put to him by the defense attorneys, Stephen Meshbacher and Adam Johnson. Johnson would question Jeremy, and he had literally a book of them in front of him. An hour later, while Johnson had tried to trip up Jeremy, he had held his own. Every time Johnson asked a long, drawn-out, multi-part question, Jeremy responded, quote, can you please repeat that? End quote. And while some attorneys become befuddled, Johnson did handle it like a professional. He asked about the Miranda warning, which, if you recall, Jeremy meticulously repeated, asked, clarified, and asked again if Byron understood his rights. And Jeremy had years of experience drafting search warrants and understood that should the statements or warrants get thrown out, they'd lose everything Byron had admitted, plus the digital audio recording and surveillance video, which would make the case untenable. Johnson finished his query, and Orput did the cross, clarifying, cinching up important facts. Then all of this was entered into evidence to await the judge's ruling. Being a perfectionist, Jeremy prided himself on being thorough, and confirming this later, Orput had no issues with anything he or the rest of the team had said. But Judge Anderson had 30 days to render his decision. Anxious until he knew the outcome, Jeremy suffered through a number of sleepless nights. But fortunately, before the 30 days was up, Orput called Jeremy with the news. Everything had gone their way. All of this evidence would be presented at trial. So with the media transfixed on the Smith case, a lot of terms were being tossed around. So let me, in my best layman's fashion, explain the laws involved here and the statutes specific to Minnesota. Now, I am citing my research, so I'm not giving you legal advice here. All right, historically, our legal jurisprudence was inherited from our British forefathers. So basically, castle doctrine stemmed from 17th century English common law that grants people the right to defend their lives and property against a threatening intruder, possibly even using deadly force. A man's home is his castle. In the 1980s, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, a few states had what were nicknamed Make My Day laws after the Clint Eastwood Dirty Harry film series. These laws granted immunity from prosecution when one uses deadly force against someone who has unlawfully and forcibly entered a person's home. In 2005, Florida passed the country's first Stand My Ground laws, which stated, quote, a person who is not engaged in an unlawful activity and who is attacked in any place where he or she has a right to be has no duty to retreat and has the right to stand his or her ground and meet force with force, including deadly force, if he or she reasonably believes it is necessary to do so to prevent death or great bodily harm to himself or herself or another, or to prevent the commission of a forcible felony, end quote. So that law applies outside one's home. Castle doctrine applies to being inside one's home and defending oneself. So it does differ from the stand your ground laws. So while each law is unique to each state, generally, the Stand Your Ground laws broaden the castle doctrine to the outside, widening the concept to apply anywhere you can legally be where you feel threatened, not necessarily just on your property. So this would include your workplace, inside your car, parking lot, parking garage. You get the idea. Laws in at least 38 states in Puerto Rico have no requirement for you to retreat from an attacker, provided you are lawfully present. Now, some states have a duty to retreat law, which means you cannot harm someone in self-defense if it is feasible to retreat from a threatening situation and find a place of safety. The 2024 duty to retreat states are Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, and Minnesota, where our story comes from, Nebraska, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin. Proponents of the duty to retreat laws argue that lives are saved by preventing a violent confrontation. And in all duty to retreat states, the duty to retreat does not apply when the defender is in their own home. As of today in the United States, 48 states have castle doctrine laws. Regarding non-deadly force, you are allowed to use non-deadly force to defend yourself anywhere. You are not allowed to use deadly force against minor crimes. So in a nutshell, the responding force must be proportional. If you invade my home threatening me while committing a crime, I have the right to defend myself, including deadly force. When the threat is neutralized, the defense ceases. Now, some states have both a castle doctrine and a stand your ground law, such as in Iowa. However, broad or narrow, the law just depends on the state. A duty to retreat state, Minnesota has a law called defensive dwelling, technically not the castle doctrine. If a homeowner reasonably believes their life is threatened, he or she can use deadly force to protect him or herself and their property in their home. So there are some important distinctions here. For example, if you are in a bar and someone begins harassing you, threatening you in a stand your ground state, you do not need to leave and you have a perfect legal right to be in the bar and can reasonably and proportionally defend yourself if you're attacked. Same situation in a duty to retreat state. You must exit the situation to escape and go somewhere safe, removing yourself from the dangerous situation. If you don't leave and the person attacks you, you have lost your right to use deadly force for self-defense. All right, I have links on my blog that help identify which state has what, so you can check it out at www.murdershelfbookclub.com. Now, in Minnesota, with no castle doctrine per se, the defensive dwelling law only applies to a person's home, excluding apartment hallways and common areas. And it is a duty to retreat state. So one must retreat from a threat except in one's own home. Once on the inside and the intruder is neutralized, it is all over. Call 911. So, in 2012, Jeremy explains that legal self-defense in Minnesota is an affirmative defense tied to the reasonableness of the action taken by a defendant and whether the defendant could have avoided the situation. Now, according to Cornell Law School, an affirmative defense is, quote, a defense in which the defendant introduces evidence which, if found to be credible, will negate criminal or civil liability, even if it is proven that the defendant committed the alleged acts, end quote. Previous Minnesota court rulings have generated four elements necessary for a successful self-defense claim. One, the defendant isn't the aggressor and did not provoke the alleged victim. Two, the defense had an actual and honest belief in imminent danger. Three, there is a reasonable basis for this belief exists. And four, a reasonable means to retreat and otherwise avoid physical conflict were not available. All of these legal nuances were emotionally gnashed out by media outlets in the weeks, months, and years leading to Byron Smith's trial. For some, the decision to arrest Smith was outrageous. They believed the arrest and prosecution violated the Castle Doctrine and the right to conceal carry permit holders to defend their homes. Others believed that the forced entry intruders were an imminent threat, while also believing that there are limits on how much force can and should be reasonably applied when defending one's property. Sheriff Witzel addressed this at a news conference saying, quote, "This isn't a case about whether you have the right to defend yourself in your home. You clearly do. That is a given. Rather, this is a case about where the limits are," end quote. Did Byron Smith's defense meet the criteria laid out by previous courts of appeal? Well, only the 12-person jury could decide his fate. Would the evidence presented by the prosecution be sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Byron Smith had committed premeditated murder? Or did the defense of dwelling protect him as he was legally allowed to defend his home? Well, the jury trial would begin on April 21st, 2014. After endless months of harassing drive-bys propagated by the Friends of Byron Smith group, Chrissy was stressed to the breaking point, compounded by nasty comments from people with the media inflaming people's passions. She announced she wanted to move out of town. Well, Jeremy didn't want to move away from his brother, but he didn't want to lose his marriage either. Quote, "I never, in my wildest dreams, imagined this case would have such an impact on my life. In college and at cop training, they don't teach aspiring officers about the impacts a case can have on your personal life," end quote. Resigned, they began house hunting, and soon she found a house she liked, out of town and away from traffic. Offer accepted, they'd manage both payments until their home sold. Packing, moving, and fixing up the new house took all of their spare time. A few days before the trial began, Peter Orput and Brent Wartner came by the sheriff's office to see Jeremy, and Peter looked like he'd aged a decade, admitting his nerves were frayed. Jeremy offered his support, whatever they needed, with Peter and Brent greatly appreciative. Well, April 21st, 2014 finally arrived. Six men and six women were impaneled as the jury as opening statements began. Wartner began with Smith's home being burglarized multiple times, making him very angry. He waited in the basement when Brady broke in, followed by Kiefer, and shot each of them multiple times, continuing after the first shot incapacitated them. Their deaths were not reported to the sheriff's office until the following day by neighbor Bill Anderson, who called 911. Defense attorney Meshbecker countered, saying that this wasn't a whodunit. Smith shot and killed two people, but he was not criminally liable for their deaths. The prosecution's first witness, Deputy Dave Sherping, took the stand, explaining the sequence of events that unfolded after Anderson called 911. Then, the mothers of Nick and Haley, Kim Brady and Jenny Kiefer, testified about learning their children were dead. Jeremy then followed the mothers, walking past news media TV cameras, which made his nervousness all the worse. He noticed the courtroom was packed with journalists as he put his hand up to swear to tell the truth. Waiting for Judge Anderson, his legs began to jump, and picturing everyone naked did not work, as he prayed he would not screw this up. After telling the jury who he was and his role in the sheriff's department, he got down to the call to Smith's house, pausing at Bill Anderson's first, and he confirmed what Deputy Sherping had told the jury. He was very specific about times, which he had memorized, fluidly reciting the exact sequence of events as they unfolded. When he arrived at taking Smith's statement, Prosecutor Wartner stopped him and played the audio interviews with Smith that Jeremy had recorded, with the jury having transcripts. Then the defense had their shot at Deputy Lubert's. He expected to be bombarded with a million questions, but Meshbesher only had a few simple ones. And when Jeremy was dismissed, day one of the trial was over. Afterward, Peter Orput was thrilled with Jeremy's specificity on the stand. "Well, review a report a couple hundred times and you are ready to rock and roll." Jeremy learned that Judge Anderson had prohibited the defense from bringing up the crimes that Nick and Haley had previously done, as this trial was about what Byron had done, not them. Heading back to his office, Jeremy found a letter on his desk, an official commendation from Sheriff Wetzel for his work on the Smith homicide case, but coming before the jury verdict was in. Wetzel wrote, quote, "This is not an accident. While I am confident that Smith will be convicted of homicide, juries are strange things, and you can never know for certain how they will vote until the very end. I deliberately issued this letter now, because regardless of the jury's verdict, your work is deserving of recognition as the finest my office has to offer," end quote. And that from the sheriff who hadn't been sure that Jeremy should be the one to interview Smith, right? I remember that. Do you remember that? I do. Stunned, Jeremy recognized the high honor of receiving such recognition from the sheriff, glowing as he came home. He showed it to Chrissy, who told him that he deserved it. Trial day two began with the prosecution playing the audio clip from the digital recorders, which must have been devastating for the jury to hear. This was followed up by testimony from BCA senior agent Chad Macias, who explained on finding the audio clips on top of the bookshelf by the reading chair in the basement and the odd configuration. Then came BCA forensic specialist Nathaniel Carlson with photographs of the Smith crime scene, the broken window, basement views, water jug and snacks easily seen on the table next to the Lazy Boy, and diagrams of Smith's home and basement. Photos of the bodies in the office area were shown wrapped up in a tarp. Gun evidence and ballistics were also presented. The location of blood found pooled under the rug in Smith's basement and the spatter on the walls of the stairs were shared with the jury. Carlson testified that the light bulbs had been removed from three light fixtures, the six bulbs visible near the bookcase. He said further that Kiefer's hoodie had holes in it with gun residue and that one of the shots was fired within 6 inches of her. Oh, that doesn't sound good for Smith. Under cross, Carlson explained how he determined the range from which a gun was fired, which was reflected in his notes. Defense attorney Adam Johnson then called for a mistrial, as the defense had not been provided with Carlson's notes during discovery. Prosecutor Wartner countered that the state had provided all the evidence and had even made available to the defense, quote, "the opportunity to view evidence that was not in the state's possession, but was available through other agencies. The state is not required to carry it to them," end quote. Judge Anderson denied a mistrial, but offered copies of the notes instead. The defense then called for a mistrial again due to Judge Anderson's prior ruling that the teen's cell phones were not admissible. This was denied again. Then they asked for a mistrial based on comments the prosecution had made to the media. Again, motion denied. Day 3. Carlson's testimony continued, answering questions about the blood, shell casing, gun residue on the clothing, and next up was BCA agent Janet Nelson, testifying on the analysis of the digital audio recorders. Due to long pauses and empty air, she reduced the recording to 29 minutes, as permitted by law. This is not tampering. She also testified about the exterior video recordings from the surveillance system, which Orput played for the jury. They saw the time-stamped video of Smith getting into his truck and leaving his property and returning on foot at 11:45 a.m. At 12:33 p.m., Brady arrives at the house, turning the video camera upside down. He walks around, hands over his face, testing doorknobs, and going to the back of the home at 12:39 p.m. At 12:51, Kiefer appears, running across the driveway with her cell phone to her ear. She is last seen at 12:53 p.m. Dr. Kelly Mills, the medical examiner, testified about the autopsies, injuries suffered, and cause of death for Nick Brady and Haley Kiefer. Any of the three shots Nick Brady had suffered could have been fatal, but the gunshot that entered his brain caused his death. She had used the audio recordings to determine precisely when Brady stopped moaning. Moving on to Kiefer, Dr. Mills explained that two types of ammunition were fired at her. The fatal shot was from close range, since charring occurs when the gun is close to the skin's surface. That bullet traveled through Kiefer's neck, left tonsil, and into her skull, where it damaged her brainstem, which regulates our autonomic system. The cause of death in both cases was, quote, multiple gunshot wounds, homicide, end quote. Defense attorney Meshbecker asked her about the term homicide, which means one person killing another, which is not necessarily murder. He later asked Dr. Mills if a person acted in self-defense or in defense of his home, the manner of death would still be listed as multiple gunshot wounds homicide, with her agreeing it would. He asked how she determined when a wound was or wasn't fatal, and could she determine where on the stairs a person had been shot? Well, she could because of the audio recording when Brady could be heard. Had Brady been disabled by the first shot, Dr. Mills confirmed that Brady would have had the ability to stand, but not use his right hand. Meshbecker asked, if Nick had a gun in his sweatshirt, could he have used it in his left hand to fire? Well, yes, theoretically. After the first gunshot wounds, could a person still be dangerously violent, inflicting deadly force beyond the control of the shooter? Mills conceded that that was possible. For Kiefer's injuries, Meshbecker asked about the six shots she had suffered. Again, Dr. Mills had used the audio to separate the shots. Had the first wound she'd received incapacitated her, or could she still move? Mills agreed that Kiefer would have been able to move three of her four limbs. Meshbecker then asked about Kiefer making sounds on the audio. Could a deceased body continue to make sounds? Mills stated that the sounds could be heard from air coming from a body when a body is moved from side to side. Could Smith have heard a post-mortem sound when he told law enforcement that he heard a noise from Kiefer after the fifth shot? Mills replied, quote, if he was moving her, end quote. When asked about Kiefer's toxicology report, Mills said Kiefer was considered intoxicated by the amount of dextromethorphan in her system, and it could produce hallucinations, alter perceptions, and possibly cause a psychotic effect in a chronic abuser. The last witness was BCA forensic scientist Brent Maskey, who had done the DNA analysis and confirmed that Haley Kiefer's blood was found on Smith's revolver and pants. The state rested. Meeting with the judge, Meshbecker moved for formal acquittal, with the judge denying the motion. The defense was up. Jamie Lubertz was called to the stand to testify about the October burglary of Smith's house. The bottom panel of the basement door had been kicked out, areas had been ransacked, and photographs were shown to verify this. He had developed no leads and had followed up with Smith 20 days afterwards. He said that Smith had come to the office with a list of stolen items, including a camera lens, a Nikon camera worth thousands of dollars, gold coins, cash, a gold ring, and rifle scope. Sheriff Wetzel was then called to the stand, and he said that on November 29, 2012, he learned where Smith's stolen shotgun might be, and it resulted in its recovery. With the weekend off, everyone returned on Monday. Private investigator Ross Rolshevin was sworn in. He spoke about the panel kicked down on the basement door and the shoe prints stemming from the October burglary. The defense now presented Nick Brady's shoes found in Smith's basement, but the prosecution objected to comparing the tread on the shoes to the door because the connection was irrelevant given Judge Anderson's previous ruling. Now Judge Anderson agreed having ruled on the pretrial motion that the shoes connecting the two burglaries was irrelevant. Smith did not actually know who had broken in October. He thought the girl was his neighbor, Ashley Williams, having no idea it was Haley Kiefer. Therefore, Smith did not know if the same people had returned that Thanksgiving day. Now, three character witnesses were called. Bruce Smith, Byron's brother, who recalled Byron's work with the Eagle Scouts. Neighbor Kathleen Lang and her 16-year-old son also testified. Kathleen Lang said that Byron Smith had lived with her for 16 months and was an honest person. Dylan Lang stated that he and his band were allowed to practice in Byron's detached garage, and he thought Smith was an honest person too. Orput asked the teenager about practicing in the garage. Hadn't they been kicked out? But Lang insisted that they had left to practice elsewhere. With Smith exercising his right to remain silent, the judge explained Minnesota law on defensive dwelling and that the defendant had no duty to retreat, but his actions must have been reasonable under the circumstances. The jury needed to follow the law as explained, even if they disagreed with it and think the law should be different. And pack an overnight bag. This jury would be sequestered until they reached a verdict. The next day was closing arguments. Orput kept it simple. Evidence proved that Smith had enacted a plan, being determined to kill 17-year-old Nick Brady and 18-year-old Haley Kiefer. He moved his truck. He had a tarp in the basement. He had snacks and water next to his chair, secreting him away in the dark since he'd removed the light bulbs. Orput played the audio recordings of the shooting again, with Smith covering his face, appearing to be crying. He also played the audio from after the shooting, with a transcript projected on a screen with time references. 24 minutes before, quote, in your left eye, end quote. And then Byron appears to rehearse what he planned to say after the shootings. 1 hour and 40 minutes after, quote, I felt like I was cleaning up a mess. Worse than spilled food. Worse than vomit. Worse than shit. You're dead. End quote. 1 hour and 46 minutes in. Quote. They weren't human. I don't see them as human. I see them as vermin. Social mistakes. End quote. 4 hours after. Quote. Cool. Exciting. Highly profitable. Until someone kills you. End quote. And Byron Smith would ramble on for another 90 minutes. All of it is in Jeremy's book, which you really need to read. Orput asked the jury, quote, was it fear that drove this or something else? Anger? Resentment? Now it's your case. You know what his state of mind was. Just bring back just verdicts. That's all. End quote. Mesh Becker began by highlighting Nick and Haley. From parking their car down the street, breaking the windows, covering their faces, wearing gloves. Then Haley joining Nick inside after hearing three shots, which should have warned her not to enter. Only Haley thought Nick had shot the gun. If they hadn't committed felony burglary, they would still be alive. This happened in Smith's home, and homes are supposed to be a place where people felt safe. Not scared. He thanked the jury and repeated that Smith was acting in self-defense. And with that, the judge dismissed the jurors to begin deliberations. Jeremy, Orput, Wortner, Mindorf, Kosevich all went to the local black and white restaurant about two blocks down. They were sitting and talking when dispatch called, quote, the jury wanted to know if they convict Smith on a first-degree murder charge, do they have to consider the second-degree murder charges? End quote. Well, that sounds good for the prosecution. During lunch, Jeremy was greeted by people he had known his entire life, saying that they had seen all of them on the news and appreciated the work that they were doing. And this meant a great deal to him, making him proud to be from Little Falls. 3 hours later, the jury reached a verdict, with Jeremy going in to listen, along with reporters flocking and bustling about. With Byron and the defense poised at their table, the prosecution at theirs, the jury walked into a tension-filled courtroom. The judge began, accepting the verdict form from the foreperson. He read it and returned it to the court administrator, with anticipation making everyone about to blow a gasket. 2 years of hard work, mean criticism, deep concern for Jeremy's family and safety was about to be over. Quote, on the first count of murder in the first degree, with premeditation regarding Nicholas Brady, we, the jury, find Byron Smith guilty as charged. On the second count of murder in the first degree, with premeditation regarding Haley Kiefer, the jury finds Byron Smith guilty as charged. End quote. In the end, Byron Smith was found guilty on all four charges. Relief, satisfaction, Jeremy saw that the Brady and Kiefer families were crying, and the judge dismissed the jury and moved on to sentencing. Peter Orput asked Judge Anderson for the maximum, life without the possibility of parole, and consecutive life sentences. Judge Anderson denied this because ultimately consecutive sentences would not change the length of 67-year-old Byron Smith. He would still get life without the possibility of parole. Then the Brady and Kiefer family members read victim impact statements for the court. Lori Skipper, Haley's aunt, called Smith's actions a conscious decision that took her niece away from the family forever. The day of the shooting was the worst day of their lives, and listening to the audio recording was unbearable. It would haunt them forever. Quote, now there are two empty seats at every one of them, meaning Thanksgiving, and every other holiday, celebration, family milestone. She was a beautiful girl. It was senseless what happened, and we're going to miss her forever. And there's nothing we can do to bring her back. A senseless tragedy. End quote. Nick Brady's mother, Kimberly Brady, described her son as kind, big-hearted, and eager to learn. Quote, not seeing him anymore is a great tragedy, a tremendous sadness that never seems to go away. I often think about what he could have been, and I see other men with their dads or moms, and it's really, really difficult. And then I have to think that I will never have that chance again. End quote. Nick's grandma, Bonnie Schaefel, said Smith, quote, seemed like a sour, angry old recluse who felt he was above the law, end quote. She was sorry his house was burglarized, adding, quote, Haley and Nick should have had the consequences so they could learn from their mistakes. Mr. Smith took that away from them. Smith was robbed of things. Nick and Haley were robbed of their lives, end quote. Byron Smith declined to give any statements and was remanded into custody and taken upstairs to jail. He was transported to St. Cloud Prison, en route to a maximum security prison, where he would spend the remainder of his life. Mesh Besher told the media that the verdict was a wrongful conviction, and he would take the case to the Minnesota Supreme Court, with Jeremy watching his grandstanding. All first-degree murder convictions are automatically reviewed before the Minnesota Supreme Court. Orput, he was definitely not gloating. Instead, he felt deep sadness. Quote, we've got two dead kids over nothing. End quote. Next came the post-conviction news conference led by the sheriff. And he reminded everyone that this case was not about a person's right to protect himself in his own home. That was a given. This case was about deciding where the limits were before and after a threat occurred. Quote, in this case, a jury decided there are limits, and they've decided where they are. My office respects the process, and we respect the jury's verdict. There are no winners in this case. Three people had lost their lives in this matter. This wasn't a case about self-protection, but rather a senseless, sad, premeditated murder of two kids, end quote. Stephen Schaefel, Brady's grandpa, also spoke from the heart. Quote, these kids made a dumb mistake. I have made huge, stupid mistakes in my life, but I'm alive to talk about it. Justice was served today in that verdict, end quote. A few jurors also spoke. The Star Tribune reports that juror Thomas Stamberg said, quote, "For the most part, we were all pretty much in agreement from the start. We just wanted to make sure we thought about all of the evidence that was in front of us, and we wanted to go over everything that we had. Other than that, there wasn't a whole lot of sticking points," end quote. Juror Evelyn Morosla agreed, adding that one juror held out from agreeing to the guilty verdicts for a while, but, quote, "even the lone holdout wasn't arguing for acquittal, but wanted to be sure," end quote. Another indicated that the audio tapes had sealed the verdict for the jury, quote, "we were dealing with a deranged individual," end quote. Several others indicated it was a tough case to hear, but not to decide. Smith's supporter and friend John Lang told channel KARE-11 that the verdict, quote, "just told every drug addict in the country that they can rob all the elderly people and break into their homes and get away with it," end quote. Jeremy went home and told Chrissy the great news and that it was finally over. Life could get back to normal. He hoped that everyone felt this way, fearing that some might not let it go. They finished up painting the new house as a sad Jamie helped them move. And a few weeks later, Dateline NBC reached out, wanting to do a Byron Smith show and wanting to interview Jeremy. He agreed, finally able to talk about the case, and he hoped that people might understand what the case had actually been about. And it was pretty exciting to be on national TV. All right, I did watch Dateline's 12 Minutes on Elm Street, and it was well done, and I highly recommend it. Of course, I put a link on my blog. You know where that is. Now, moving past this difficult period, Jeremy was busy with new house projects, trimming trees, putting in central air, mowing two lawns, because their old house hadn't sold yet. Now, all of these Luberts had hoped that the harassment would end with the verdict, but it did not. The Friends of Byron Smith Coalition was working overtime to secure Byron's appeal, inspiring some twisted folks to make threatening phone calls, blaming Jeremy for arresting Smith. He was responsible for the convictions, which is just plain stupid. That is not how our system works. People, the police officers collect the evidence. They go to the prosecutor, who determines if they have enough to make a case. Then a grand jury of our peers is chosen to determine if the prosecution has a case. And then the jury has the final word, not the police officer. Engaging in this kind of behavior is reprehensible and shows distinct ignorance. My God, watch a couple Law & Order episodes for a few hours. Yeah, my dander's up and I get cranky now. I don't like that. Jeremy told the Morris County Record, quote, "I was the one getting blamed for what Byron did. The people that were mad at me in particular are gun rights advocates, permit to carry owners. They are the ones who were extremely mad because they thought law enforcement in particular was going after people trying to take their legal gun rights away," end quote. And that's not what this case is about. And if I've done even a modestly decent job of explaining the nuances of this case, you realize it has nothing to do with the Second Amendment. I support our Constitution, support our Bill of Rights, support the Second Amendment as part of the Bill of Rights. I own guns, and I am also entirely tolerant of those who dislike it because I am a mature grown-up adult and I can agree to disagree. But this case is not about that. When victims are less than perfect, less than innocent themselves, they still deserve proportional justice, which is what was received with the verdict of life in prison without parole. Well, nevertheless, Chrissy continued to be hassled, a nurse who had absolutely nothing to do with the arrest, the case, the trial, or the verdict. But she is harassed because she is married to Jeremy. And all of this had serious ramifications for Jeremy Luberts. 4 months after the trial, Chrissy hit rock bottom and asked for a divorce. She could not go on like this anymore, utterly devastating Jeremy. But this kind man understood what Chrissy had been through, destroyed as he was, that it's hard being married to law enforcement, very hard. None of what happened to her was his fault, but Jeremy apologized to Chrissy anyway, They came to a peaceful resolution. She kept the new house. He moved back into the old one, being very glad it hadn't sold. Divorce finalized. Jeremy sat alone, looking out the window, reflecting, quote, Nick and Haley, two teenagers, lost their lives. Byron lost his freedom. And Jeremy had lost his family, end quote. Ugh, God, I feel terrible about this. It's just so unfair. On writing his book in 2023, commented, quote, It was a heck of a case to go through. In fact, it was quite detrimental to me, end quote. Well, Byron Smith believed in the castle doctrine and felt hunted by burglars who had stolen valued possessions and violated his home and haven. I don't dispute this. He is not wrong. But he crossed a line when he decided to lure them in and become judge, jury, and executioner, and entrapped a very willing and cooperative Nicholas Brady and Haley Kiefer, who were engaged in serious criminal behavior. But they didn't deserve the death penalty imposed by Smith, who erred, and now he is paying the price, as he should. Following the trial, the families of Nicholas and Haley submitted restitution requests totaling more than $42,000 for out-of-pocket expenses, such as funeral costs, mileage to and from the court hearings, and loss of wages for the parents. Morrison County District Judge Anderson ruled that Smith should pay $9,570 to the Brady family and $11,840 to Kiefer's family as restitution. In 2015, Mesh Becker appealed to the Minnesota Supreme Court on several grounds, claiming the trial was fraught with errors. In a March 2016 decision, the Minnesota Supreme Court affirmed Smith's conviction. The state justices ruled that a closed proceeding to discuss a ruling on pre-trial evidence did not violate Smith's right to a public trial, nor did excluding four pieces of evidence violate his rights to a full, robust defense. The defense had also objected to excluding evidence about Brady's previous burglarizing of Smith's home, where he had stolen the two guns, which would have gone towards Byron Smith's fear. Well, the problem is that Byron did not know that Brady had stolen the guns in October, a month before the Thanksgiving Day murders. Remember that from Byron's statements to Jeremy, he suspected the burglars were neighbors, not Brady and Kiefer. And once again, closing the courtroom for a short administrative procedure does not inhibit the right to a public trial. Of this ruling, Nick's grandfather spoke to KARE 11 saying, quote, Well, I'm obviously pleased, as is the entire family. Been a long, long drawn-out ordeal. Personally, I never doubted that Byron Smith got a fair trial. I thought the prosecution laid out this case that was absolutely flawless as far as I was concerned, end quote. Not giving up, they appealed to the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, addressing again the brief closure of the courtroom to discuss the pretrial evidence ruling. The 8th Circuit denied his appeal. Byron Smith's constitutional right to a public trial was not violated. Not deterred, Mesh Becker appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, who only takes cases dealing with questions of constitutionality, or in this case, the Sixth Amendment. And in March 2021, the Supreme Court of the United States declined to accept Byron Smith's appeal for review. So to be fair, I did review the Justice for Byron Smith webpage thoroughly, and there is a link on my blog to it. It provides full biographical information on Byron, with supporting photos, detailing his family, military service, career, travels, and hobbies. It also provides a timeline of events leading up to the murders. The webpage accuses the audio tape of being doctored. All right, there is no evidence for this whatsoever. It accuses Deputy Jamie Lubberts of failing to follow up on the previous burglary. Only after Nicholas Brady was killed did investigators have a lead into the October burglary, which I explained to you in detail, leading to participants, young Casper and Creasel, who were arrested for possession of stolen property. Sadly, the site is biased, full of inaccuracies, and I did not find it convincing after reading the court verdicts on the appeals. And that concludes my trilogy on Murder on Elm Street, a true story by Jeremy L. Lubberts. Whew, tough case, murder bookies. I am extremely excited about our next book, Levi's Eyes by Aphrodite Jones. I have long admired Miss Jones, who you may recall from her appearances on the ID TV series, True Crime with Aphrodite Jones. I thought I was familiar with this story, but I was wrong. The depth and breadth of what Aphrodite Jones presents is mind-blowing. The murders of Christine and Levi Carlson, committed 17 years apart. And we hear from the killer himself and how the threads that bind these two murders together are exposed. Thank you for listening, Murder Bookies. I see you as you hear me. Share your thoughts with me at jill@murdershelfbookclub.com or on Twitter X or Facebook, Instagram, or join Patreon for $4 a month. Hey, we are out on YouTube now, so you can even hear my episodes there. New spring designs are out on Spreadshop, so get your merch. Links are on my blog at www.murdershelfbookclub.com with sources, photographs, show notes, our snack, recipe, and wine pairing too. Always trust your guts and lock your doors. And dextromethorphan. Written and produced by Jill, all rights reserved. Music by Carl Hosena and lyrics by Otto Harbach.